I call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April the 8th, 2026. We have a quorum present. First, a reminder about our committee rules. Signs are not permitted in the committee room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, applause, or other disruptions are not allowed. Sitting or standing in the aisles is not permitted, and the State Patrol and House Security staff are present to ensure everyone's safety. If you leave the committee room, please hang on to your tickets to re-enter. Thank you for all of your attention and participation in the committee's work. So first order of business is to approve the minutes from Wednesday, March 25th. And Representative Ryer, Vice Chair Ryer, have you reviewed the minutes and do you approve?
I have reviewed the minutes and move their approval.
There's a motion to approve the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Minutes from March 25th are approved. First on the docket, we'll welcome Representative Khatija Watoon to the committee. House File 4609. This is welcome to the committee, Representative Khatija Watoon. I'll move House File 4609 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Khatija Watoon, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Schumacher, for allowing me to present House File 4609 today. I can't tell you how much it means to me personally and to the hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans who suffer from infertility in building their families. House File 4609 is the Minnesota Building Families Act. It is a simple bill with an inarticulable impact. It would require insurance companies to cover the cost of infertility diagnosis and treatments. So many Minnesotans are waiting and excited to grow their families but cannot because their health insurance doesn't cover diagnosis and treatment of infertility. Families cash out their 401ks, take out second mortgages on their homes, max out credit cards, take out loans, and even have bake sales just to have a child. Extreme financial stress is not the way that any family wants to welcome their child into the world. The Minnesota Building Families Act would lower cost sharing and provide access to infertility diagnosis and treatment for the 1 in 7 couples dealing with infertility. For the last number of years, actually, Representative Long first introduced this bill when during my first term and here in the legislature. So I have had Minnesotans reaching out to my office from across the state begging for relief in this area. And I'm proud that this bill is bipartisan in the Senate. And I do want to thank our Republican colleagues for sharing feedback here in the House as well. We may not agree on every issue, but I think we do all agree that Minnesotans who want to start a family should be able to do so. Over the past few weeks, I think a number of you have had conversations with a variety of advocates, and I think that there has been some confusion about what the bill does. And I just want to clear that up today before we get to testimony and discussion. I do understand that there are varying opinions about surrogacy, both in the legislature and across the state. The Minnesota Building Families Act does not change anything about the way that surrogacy currently operates in the state of Minnesota. A person's insurance covers their own medical care, and the Minnesota Building Families Act would cover an individual's diagnosis and treatment for infertility, period. Surrogates, by definition, are not people who experience infertility. Language in this bill about third parties exists because not every person or couple who uses assisted reproductive technology to become a parent does so with their own genetic material. Without third-party language, insurance companies would deny infertility treatments to couples who intend to donate their embryos after completing their family or deny couples coverage if they are getting pregnant with donated embryos. In addition to being entirely unacceptable, it would also be unworkable to ask insurance companies to determine every person's or couple's intent with their embryos after they complete their family. Surrogacy does happen, of course, in Minnesota, but instead of being regulated through state law, it is handled with contracts and lawyers. Health insurance coverage for health care treatments for individuals cannot pay for contracts and lawyers for other people. Finally, I do want to note that there was a bill in the Senate last biennium, carried by Senator Mae Quaid, to regulate surrogacy in the state of Minnesota. But there were objections from folks you may hear from today about the lack of regulation. That provision has not yet been passed into law. So I think that is a really important part of the conversation that we should have here at the legislature. But the Minnesota Building Families Act is not the bill that will change that. Extending insurance coverage to cover a medical diagnosis and treatment of infertility is not only logical, but I do believe that this is the right thing to do. And I would urge the committee to support. I know we're laying this bill over. There also, because of the shortness of the session, I do want to point out that House File 4609 already contains a religious exemption element. The bill that is being heard in Commerce tomorrow does not yet have the religious exemption amendment, but we will be bringing that forward. This language is the new and correct language that we want to move forward with this session. The bill previously was referred to Commerce, and because of delays at the revisor's office, this bill just came straight to Health before stopping Commerce. So just to clarify that. If we want Minnesota to be the best state to raise a family, we also have to be the best state to start a family. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would ask for my testifiers to join me.
Thank you, Representative Katisa-Watun, for the overview of the bill. And we'll move to testifiers. First testifier, Mariah Gryan, and second one, Jennifer Stein, if you could head toward the table. Thank you. Please take your seat and then introduce yourselves for the committee, and then you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Becker, and committee. My name is Mariah Gryan, and I am the president of the Minnesota Building Families Association and a patient advocate. Before I begin, I'd like to propose a hypothetical question to the committee. For those of you who are parents or dream of becoming parents, how much of your financial future would you risk for your child? Now I want you to imagine yourself sitting at your kitchen table, surrounded by medical bills. Your heart is heavy, and every day you wonder how you will make ends meet. You ask yourself, at what point would I be forced to give up? In that moment, giving up would mean the devastating reality of never getting the chance to meet your child, the child you dream of and have fought for. This isn't hypothetical for many Minnesotans, it's reality. In Minnesota, 1 in 6 experience infertility, more than 186,000 people, some of which who are here today wearing orange. Half of them are men and half of them are women. Nearly 10% of cancer patients, about 8,000 Minnesotans, may need fertility preservation to build their family. I've faced infertility for over a decade, 7 miscarriages, 2 IVF cycles, out-of-pocket costs due to the lack of insurance coverage. My husband and I took out a second mortgage and used retirement savings to have our daughter, who just turned 5 last month, and she's over there. Nice. We still have 2 embryos remaining, but without insurance coverage, we can't afford to add to our family. My story is not unique. Without fertility insurance, families drain savings, max out credit cards, and take out second mortgages, all to chase the dream of parenthood. The emotional and financial toll is overwhelming. House File 4609 offers the solution. Studies show that when insurance covers IVF, health outcomes improve for babies and mothers. Healthcare costs go down. In the 25 other states across this country that have passed fertility coverage laws, there has been little impact on insurance premiums. A 2021 Mercer study of over 450 employers found that 97% of employers offering fertility coverage, including IVF, saw no significant increase in medical costs. Many of the larger Minnesota corporations here, such as General Mills and 3M, carry this for their employees. This bill would help smaller businesses in competing with the larger businesses by offering competitive health insurance coverage. Fertility coverage doesn't just save families and businesses financially, it saves lives too. Patients are more likely to choose single embryo transfer, reducing high-risk pregnancies and costly NICU stays. A recent study by the Women's Health Research and Action Center shows 65% of Americans support mandated insurance coverage for fertility treatment. Even legislators such as yourselves have insurance coverage for fertility. The families you represent deserve the same access. Without infertility insurance, families must pay out of pocket for care that insurers can negotiate at lower rates. The burden falls entirely on families, not the insurers who benefit. You may hear from the opposition today that infertility can be treated by addressing root causes instead of IVF. Many patients have, like myself, have tried other options and discovered that they need IVF to build their family. Suggesting otherwise overlooks the complexity of infertility and undermines the patient. This ideology also disregards patients who need fertility care because of cancer. So I asked you earlier, how much would you risk for your child? Perhaps your children or grandchildren will face this question one day. House File 4609 gives you the chance to act now so they will never have to ask, how much of my financial future will I risk to become a parent? Please pass House File 4609, a bipartisan pro-family bill, and give hardworking Minnesotans the reprieve they desperately need. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Cron. Next, we'll have Ms. Stein. If you could introduce yourself for the committee and proceed, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Bierman and Chair Backer and committee members. My name is Jennifer Stein, and I'm a Minnesota mother, wife, and cancer survivor spouse. In 2014, our lives changed overnight when my husband was diagnosed with leukemia. Like so many families facing cancer, we were overwhelmed with fear and uncertainty. And even today, that chapter is so painful that he doesn't like to talk about it. Following his diagnosis, his doctors told us that the treatment that would be used to save his life would also take away his ability to one day become a father. So before treatment began, he chose to preserve his fertility, and we were focused on survival, but also held on to hope. Years later, when he was healthy and we were ready to grow our family, we learned that because of the side effects of his life-saving treatments, we would also need IVF to have a child. Our employer-sponsored insurance covered only a fraction of the amount that it cost. We drained our savings, held fundraisers, and leaned in on the generosity of our families. After one round of IVF, we were blessed with our daughter, Kennedy, who was born in 2022. She's the light of our lives and the reason of everything that I do. She's here because fertility treatment made it possible and because we also had to risk our financial security. But no cancer survivor should have to fundraise to build a family. Think of someone you know who has faced cancer and imagine telling them that you may survive but lose your chance to become a parent. And not because of access to medical treatment that doesn't exist, but because your insurance simply just doesn't cover it. It's cruel and it's unnecessary and it's also fixable. We did everything right. We worked hard, paid our premiums, and we planned responsibly for our future. And still we faced overwhelming financial barriers just to build our family. Today we also have two embryos remaining, two more chances at growing our family. But with our current insurance providers, we have no fertility coverage. So once again, the door is closed by cost. Families like mine are simply asking for fair access to care that already exists. It's time for the legislature to stand with Minnesota families and pass this bill, bringing fertility insurance coverage to all hardworking Minnesotans who need it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the testimony, Ms. Stein. Next up, Dr. Chandra Sipaf-Shenoy, followed by Maggie Hange. Please state your name for the committee record and proceed.
Dear Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Dr. Chandra Pashinoy, and I'm an OBGYN and reproductive endocrinologist at Mayo Clinic. And I'm also a fertility patient. My 18-month-old son would not be here today without fertility treatments. But I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Family Building Coalition because it is likely that nearly everyone in this room know somebody who has struggled with or is currently struggling with infertility. This is not a rare condition. Infertility affects 1 in 6 individuals globally and 1 in 7 here in Minnesota. Yet despite this prevalence, too many Minnesotans pay monthly insurance premiums for plans that cover neither the diagnosis nor the standard treatment of this disease. And it is a disease. Fertility care is not a luxury. It is essential medical care. Equally as concerning, many insurance plans do not cover fertility preservation for patients diagnosed with cancers. These are often young individuals who, in the span of days, must make life-altering decisions. They have a narrow window to preserve their ability to have children. In those critical moments, they should be focused on survival and future hope, not scrambling how to figure out how to afford care. In my practice, many patients do not require advanced treatments like IVF, but many are hesitant to even walk through my door because of cost concerns. I see the consequences of these delays every single day. delays that reduce the chances of success, delays that increase the need for more invasive and expensive treatments, and most heartbreakingly, delays that take away the possibility of building a family. When IVF is needed, insurance coverage leads to better outcomes. Patients with coverage are more likely to pursue safer, evidence-based approaches like single embryo transfer. This reduces the risk of multiple births, which not only improves outcomes for mothers and babies, but also significantly lowers healthcare costs. Our goal is simple: healthy moms and healthy babies. Right now, access to fertility care largely depends on the ability to pay. I witness this inequity every day. Meanwhile, my colleagues in states with insurance mandates are able to practice medicine the way it's meant to be practiced, guided by patient need and clinical evidence rather than financial barriers. My patients deserve that same standard of care. The ability to treat a disease should not depend on your zip code or financial situation. I urge you to pass this bill for those struggling with infertility and those who are facing a cancer diagnosis. Further delays in this bill will mean more Minnesotans losing the chance to build the families they dream of. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Shenoy. Next up, Maggie Henge, followed by Rebecca Delahunt. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and members of the committee, my name is Maggie Henge, and I'm the Assistant Director for Family Policy at the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Church of Minnesota. We're speaking today in opposition to House File 4609. Please vote no. When a couple is eager to start their family, but month after month sees a negative pregnancy test, the reality is devastating. They carry a heavy burden, and we have great compassion for their circumstances. But we must recognize that children are gifts. They're not commodities to which we have an automatic right. When we look deeper into the process of these technologies, we face difficult ethical dilemmas. More children are killed at IVF clinics than at Planned Parenthood in a given year. Some reports say that up to 90% of embryos created are never born. Many are discarded as medical waste, donated to science, or left frozen for an indefinite amount of time. To determine which of the embryos will have the best chance at life, pre-implantation genetic testing is often used. In 2020, this was used in about 50% of the cases. PGT is problematic as it can lead to modern-day eugenics. We can now create designer babies with the characteristics and sex desired by their parents. This practice also comes with low success rates. Nationally, 37% of assisted reproductive technology cycles resulted in a live birth. Put the other way, 63% of all cycles fail. And the cost is staggering. It would certainly impact our healthcare premiums. We should not be using taxpayer dollars to coerce people into paying for a practice that's not good medicine or sound ethics. While proponents have tried to say otherwise, one of the more alarming aspects of this bill is that it would allow for taxpayer funding of commercial surrogacy. A single male, for example, who would be considered infertile under the definition of this bill, cannot reproduce without a surrogate who will carry his baby. In practice, surrogacy creates a marketplace where wombs become commodities and children become products. It exploits women and intentionally strips a child of the only mother he or she has known for 9 months. This has detrimental effects for all involved. We should certainly not be funding this practice without properly vetting it through the legislative process. But when discussing infertility, it's important to remember that infertility is not a disease in and of itself. It's a symptom of an underlying condition like a hormonal imbalance, blocked fallopian tube, or endometriosis. Pushing couples towards IVF and related treatments without treating the underlying cause of the infertility is problematic. A better path forward is by promoting and covering restorative reproductive medicine. RRM works with the woman's body to diagnose and treat the underlying health conditions that may be inhibiting her infertility. It is a tailored approach for each person based on her specific needs. It's often cheaper than IVF and more successful. Couples deserve better than being funneled down the assisted reproduction path. We should not misplace our compassion by trying to play God and creating children in a lab, and in some cases, separating them from one or both biological parents. Please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Rebecca Delahunt. Welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony when you're ready.
Yes. Thank you. Co-chairs Bierman, Backer, and members of the committee, Rep. Katiza-Wittun, thank you so much for having me today. My name is Rebecca Delahunt, and I work as Director of Public Policy with Minnesota Family Council. House File 4609 would mandate all health plans cover assisted reproduction services. This includes in vitro fertilization and third-party services, as included in the bill. Infertility impacts so many Minnesotans, and this is a heartbreaking journey for many in this room and many people we know and love. We do not believe that House File 4609 is the right solution. Lines 3.7 and 3.8 prohibit any restriction on fertility services provided by or to a third party, and the definition of infertility includes an inability to conceive as an individual on lines 2.3 and 2.4. I want to make a note that I appreciate Rep. Katiza-Wittun's comments that she sees this as not including surrogacy, but I don't see how the express language would not be interpreted later to require coverage. In surrogacy, eggs and sperm are sourced either from the person or people who will raise the child, called the intended parents, or purchased from a donor. Eggs and sperm are fertilized into multiple embryonic lives, and one is often selected for implantation based on quality and other characteristics. The gestational carrier, the woman carrying the baby, will hand over the baby immediately upon birth to the IPs. Most surrogacy arrangements are paid, meaning that the surrogate is paid for renting her body, and she must follow contractual requirements on medication, diet, lifestyle, etc. Surrogacy always involves the intentional stripping of a child from the only mother the baby has known, a serious injustice to those children. Though surrogacy agencies may require a background check of IPs, there is no federal or Minnesota law requiring one. There are some Wall Street Journal articles in your packets reporting on Chinese foreign national males having tens of children through U.S. surrogates getting U.S. citizenship and bringing them back to China. Surrogacy costs vary, but after compensation, agency fees, IVF embryo creation and transfer, legal fees, and other costs, the cost can be between $100,000 and $200,000. Taxpayer-funded insurance should not pay for the intentional separation of children from the only mother the baby has known. That's not good public policy making. Surrogacy is not protected in Minnesota statute, and we have argued that it should not be. But it is notable that this bill will likely be interpreted to mandate coverage of an extra statutory practice. Please vote no.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we can move to member discussion of the bill. Representative DePell.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, and for the testifiers and for bringing this bill. I generally support IVF. My brother, to the point of some of the testifiers, had cancer and was diagnosed at 16 years old. And, of course, there's a multitude of processes that take place. And I wouldn't have my niece and nephew if it wasn't for IVF and these different procedures. And so in that vein, I absolutely support IVF, and I appreciate the bill being brought forth, the continued work that's being done on it. And I also wanted to stress that having those appropriate guardrails and continuing to work with the different stakeholders and individuals who bring up good points, like the last testifier brought up about surrogacy, and making sure that we're protecting women in that process too, so they aren't exploited, and also making sure we're protecting the children. Likewise, making sure that we're doing this in a responsible way. There's over 1.5 million fertilized embryos that are currently frozen in the United States, and there are, I think, over 1,500 children waiting to be adopted in Minnesota also. That doesn't preclude that people shouldn't be able to utilize IVF as well, but they are important points to be made. And if we are going to do this responsibly, similar to what Germany does or other countries that have studied this as well, I think we can learn from other individuals who have gone down this pathway. They realize everybody wants someone to be able to start a family. I mean, truly, that is a critical part of us as humans. And so within that, being the father of six children, and my wife having a miscarriage. Our first child was miscarried. That is an extremely difficult process to go through. And for individuals who have gone through that multiple times, we have family members and friends too. So I am extremely sympathetic to that. I just want to stress that those guardrails that were addressed earlier, if those are in place, I can fully support this bill. I can't support it in its current state, but I'm very happy to hear that you're continuing to work on it and look forward to hearing about the progress. Thank you.
Any comments, Representative Katina?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, thank you so much, Representative DePell, for sharing your story of your brother, and so sorry to hear that you and your wife had to go through a miscarriage earlier on. I mentioned that my husband and I dealt with infertility when we were beginning to build our family, and while I never actually got pregnant through assisted reproductive medicine, we didn't go through IVF. Big part of that was because of the cost, and I have a large fear of needles. But we, you know, ultimately at that point in our life, we were quite young and decided that spending that kind of money or taking out loans and some of the financial decisions that other folks have to make was not a choice that we wanted to make. And so we actually pivoted and we adopted three kids out of the Minnesota Waiting Child Program. And I always do like to bring that up as a part of my testimony when I talk about this bill, because there are so many different ways that people can build a family. And, you know, and it's not blood to me that makes a family, it's love. And I know that there are adoptive parents on both sides of the aisle in this room today, and just, you know, appreciate us fully considering all of those options. And one thing I think that, you know, to the final testifier's point about foreign nationals coming into the United States to utilize surrogacy services, foreign nationals don't actually have United States health insurance. And so, like, unless they were to be Minnesota residents that had come here, naturalized, and were working through a United States healthcare program that we've subsidized here in Minnesota via the Minnesota Building Families Program, that would not be something that would be covered under this bill. So just wanted to point that out as well.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Oh, thank you so much, Chair. All right. So this definitely is a bill that brings forth some emotion. So I have a question for the doctor, and I'm sorry I forgot your name.
Dr. Pofshinoy.
Thank you. So, Chair, my question to the doctor is, you said 1 in 7 Minnesotans struggle with infertility. And my question is in your research and in your field, or just where did that data come from, and what are the underlying causes of infertility?
Dr. Puff,
identified that.
Dr. Pofshinoy.
Thank you, Chair.
There are so many causes for infertility, and that is what I study every day. That's what I studied in school, and that's what I practice every day to find the root causes and the best solutions for our patients. But that's medicine. That's not the purpose of this hearing today is to go through the diagnosis and the treatment of infertility. It's to allow us to do that work.
Representative Gilman, follow up?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Yeah, so the reason I believe it is very pertinent is for myself as a lawmaker, just understanding the root causes of things. When we create laws and bring forth legislation, there can be unintended consequences. And again, we've heard, you know, opposition and support for this. I myself have grown part of my family through adoption and also dealt with lots of infertility things. And so I empathize with people that have experienced that as well. But a health insurance mandate, again, these are big deals because the impact is just, it's so vast over the entire state. I think of us as, you know, we have a company back home, a manufacturing company, and I think of the cost as an employer and what we're trying to do right now with just what's, you know, going on in our lives as employers and what we can bring benefit-wise and how we can support and grow our business, but also that it's the people in our business and we care about them. So I'm concerned because if we don't deal with what are the underlying causes of things and we figure out why is 1 in 7 Minnesotans struggling with infertility, is it because they were born that way? Is it because you know, it's food, it's, you know, it's, it could be so many different things. You know, and I've heard stories of kids that have wished that they know more at 16 years old when they were going in and seeking supports, understanding that potentially their body reacted to the hormones they were given, and now they have an unintended consequence for the rest of their life. And so I would love, I'm going to do some more research on some studies on what are, why Minnesotans, 1 in 7 women are struggling with that. But I'm very concerned about the health impact, the mandate impact of this to insurance, and just what we offer to our employees as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Not sure if anyone wants to respond at all, but otherwise we can move on. We'll move on. I just wanted to say, Rep. Gilman, you kind of hit the nail on the head as far as what we do here as people in the government creating mandates to address healthcare, not only conditions, but disparities, and what causes those, and why do we have all of these healthcare problems? I mean, this is just one of many, and I think we're all in that work together. Thank you for the question. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along with, just to build on what you said, you know, the other thing we do here is we pay for them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so that's, you know, that's the other thing that we have to try to find the balance for. And I'm going to build off of what Representative Gilman talked about for a second. And if in fact, and everybody, before I begin, everybody wants to be able to cover everything. Every person in this committee wants to make sure that we take care of people to the best of our abilities. But, you know, the Health Committee's purpose is to try to find that balance between where do we find that coverage, how do we pay for that coverage, so that it affects the most number of people. And so if in fact your statistics are right that 1 in 7 families struggle with infertility, and if the one of the other testifiers talked about 37% of those infertility treatments are successful, we're talking about 5%. Right? I mean, 14% of the population, I mean, so we're talking about 5%. It's a small factor of success. Is that true? Is it true that 37% of infertility treatments actually result in a healthy child? That's my first question.
Representative or Dr. Pafshinoy, not sure who wants to take that one.
Yeah, I can take that. I think at baseline, humans aren't naturally fertile. Our baseline fertility each month is about 20%. And some of our fertility treatments will increase that quite a bit. IUI increases that above the baseline, and IVF is our most effective treatment that will increase that even more than that. So cumulative pregnancy rates of everybody who goes in for treatment reach up to 80%. So we are helping people. It is an emotionally difficult thing for everybody who knows infertility, because it is not a perfect science, and we don't get it right every single time, but we're working against humans are, like I said, just not naturally fertile animals like rabbits are. So we're doing great work, I promise you. There are good physicians behind all of the infertility treatments that happen in Minnesota. And yes, our cumulative success rates are at a point that we're not asking for this for nothing. There are so many babies in the world because of IVF, and there are so many more babies in the world that could be here if we had insurance mandates.
And thank you.
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, and thank you. And don't get me wrong, I wasn't challenging the efforts that doctors and infertility doctors put in. That wasn't what I was questioning. I was just trying to get to the point where if it's 1 in 7, that's basically 14%, and if there's a 37% success rate, that's 5% of the population. And that doesn't mean that you're doing anything wrong. I'm just trying to find that balance, because the next thing that I'm going to start talking about is the costs. you know? I mean, and that's what this body does. We decide what we can cover. For example, chiropractic care is not covered under medical assistance or Minnesota care. That's not covered. We don't cover occupational therapy or physical therapy for people, for adults over the age of 20. I wish we could, but we have to make these choices. And so I know that there isn't a fiscal note available for this, correct? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cattisa-Batoon, go ahead.
While we do not have a fiscal note for House File 4609, there is a fiscal note for 1758, which is the same bill, the same proposal, minus the religious exemption that Senator Aaron McQuaid and I added in for this, and reintroduced this session. So the one that's before us does not have a fiscal note that includes the religious exemption. 1758, excuse me, there is a fiscal note. I can share that with the committee.
All right, thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you. If you could share that with the committee, that would be great. My understanding is that it's somewhere around $10 million annually in all funds. Is that basically where we're at, $9.5 million?
Representative Cattisa-Batoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Doe. It's 8.6 per biennium, $8.6 million.
Per biennium?
Correct.
Representative Doe.
Okay, so that's roughly half of what the actual number, I think, is, and it could be even more than that. But we'll get to the bill. And so in section starting at 3.9 down to 3.27, you were talking about reimbursement, and this is the new section of law you're creating under 62Q.60. And so starting at 3.9, you're talking about the Commissioner of Commerce is going to reimburse health plan companies for coverage under this section. And then subdivision 7 on 3.21, the amount necessary to make the plans to repay this is just coming from, where is it coming from? The general fund? Because if I go to the end, we've got dots there for medical assistance, we've got Minnesota Care, but this is like an appropriation. And where will those dollars come from? Will they come from the Healthcare Access Fund? Will they come from the general fund? Will this be part of the forecast? Where does that amount? And I will go back to, it's a couple of million bucks, apparently. Where will that money come from?
Representative Cattisa-Batoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, so when we consider a health insurance mandate in the Commerce Committee, we always have the opportunity to include a defrayal cost where the state will cover the costs of any increased premiums. And then, of course, the health committee covers the cost of those public programs. So it would fall under the same policy for folks who are utilizing the coverage under public programs. It would go through there. But if there were costs to the large group market outside of the public programs, then there would be a defrayal cost covered through the Commerce Department that would be worked through that way.
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I don't sit on Commerce, so I don't know where that money comes from, and you didn't help me. So does it just go into the forecast? Is it just something? I mean, the bill is pretty specific, and it says the Commissioner of Commerce must reimburse health plan companies for coverage under this section. So where does that money come from?
Representative Cattisa-Batoon.
Mr. Chair, it's possible that House Nonpartisan could assist us with this question.
Ms. Stern.
Mr. Chair and members, I have a slightly different understanding of the completeness of the fiscal note. I understand that it's a draft, but maybe you have different information. But for my understanding, for the Commerce did not weigh in on the draft version that I saw, and I believe there was a actuarial analysis from 2023 that they did, and I think the range was between 5 and 18 million in the deferrals or in that piece, and I could share that with the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Sternum. I think we will come back to the fiscal note. This is being laid over. We can get some clarity. Part of that might be whether CGIP was included or not, perhaps. I'm not sure. But we should find out, because the larger number, which we talked about in 23, has changed considerably from what I'm understanding. So we can move on if we have other people on the list. One final question, yep. Representative Nadeau.
Yep, and thank you. And before I forget, I want to thank you for bringing this, because I think it's an important discussion to have. And like I say, I think everybody, I think most people want to be able to do these things. It's just that we have to balance that with some of the other things. And so the final question that I have is that you know, Minnesota has no mandates, along with a bunch of other states. And I think one of the testifiers alluded to 15 or 16 states that have IVF coverage. Other states just mandate insurance for infertility. You went a long way. You went from zero to the max. Ultimately, I mean, looking at you know, one of these sections in here where there's no limitations, you specifically state that nothing is limited. I think it was 3.7. Sorry, I think it's important that I point this out if I can find it. Yeah, starting on lines 3.3 down to 3.8. I mean, this is zero restrictions. And so my question is, we don't have any mandate right now. Why not take some steps forward rather than going to the point where the prohibition under this subdivision includes but is not limited to any exclusion, limitation, or other restriction? I mean, it's broad. Why not take a baby steps rather than going from zero to 100? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Katizu-Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nadeau, I appreciate that question. That section of the bill is actually only related to egg retrievals. And so the restrictions section is a piece of the treatment itself, but it's not covering the whole, the actual treatment itself. So we did limit the bill itself to four attempts.
Okay.
Of four cycles of IVF. So there is a upper end limit for the number of times that someone could utilize this coverage.
Ms. Graham.
And thank you, Chair Bierman. That is the recommended number by the American Society for Reproductive Medicine for an individual to access IVF, to do four egg retrievals. The reason why, like she said, that there's unlimited is, say you have five embryos, you should have a right to go back and use your insurance to access those embryos, rather than insurance cutting off and then you have the embryos and you can't go back and have insurance. So that's the thought process around that.
Thank you. We're going to move on. We have a number of questioners still. So Representative Knutson.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Katizu-Watun, for bringing this bill. I suffered from infertility. And that was probably the hardest thing that I had ever been through in my life. And it was because of IVF that I have my first three born children. And then my last one, God blessed us and let us do that on his own, on our own. I understand the struggle with infertility. And to anybody that's facing that and dealing with that, I am so sorry. It's devastating, it's traumatic, it's hard in your relationship, it puts you in a really dark, dark place. And it took me years, and I would get pregnant and then I would lose them. And that's devastating in itself. Finally, after seeking, you know, IUI and many other fertility attempts, my doctor said IVF is going to be your only option, and it's going to cost you tens of thousands of dollars, and that was really hard. What do you do? But I wanted a family, and so we sacrificed, and we did everything we could to save that money, and we did. It took us a long time, but we did it. And as we were going through in vitro, we had 4 embryos, and we used the first 2, and that's why I have my twins, and we froze the other 2. And then 18 months later, we used our other 2 embryos, and that's how I got my Emma. Only 1 survived. But right now in our state, we have 0 guardrails around these embryos. We have no protections for these embryos. I know a lady that did in vitro, and she had over 20 embryos. And she wasn't able to, obviously, use all of them. And then you're left with a decision to make. And they give you 4 options. You can freeze them indefinitely. You can donate them to a family or a person that's struggling to conceive on their own. You can donate them to science. And I don't even know what that means. Donate them to science. What can be done to those babies when you donate them to science? Or you can let them die. And I'm so thankful that we didn't have to make that decision. But so many families and so many women that go through this will have to make that decision. And to me, that would be horrifying. I believe in the sanctity of life from conception on. And if we're going to go through with helping women that are struggling with infertility, if we're going to provide assistance, we have to first come up with protections and guardrails surrounding infertility. And so I think this is putting the cart before the horse. I have met with people to try to talk about putting guardrails around those frozen embryos or those embryos. We do currently have 1.5 million frozen embryos in our country that are just waiting. But some of them have been frozen for decades, and some of them have been abandoned. And what happens to them? I think I am not opposed to infertility treatment, and I am not opposed to helping women during and couples during these very, very hard times. But until we put guardrails around this and until we make sure that we have protections in place, I just can't support this at this time. So thank you for starting the discussion, and I hope that we can talk about this more. But we're not ready for this. You know, the cost has been talked about a lot, and that is another huge concern. You know, I get emails every week, I'm sure we all do, about health insurance premiums being so high. Well, this is why. It's because we mandate coverage for different things, and somebody has to pay for that. So that's another concern, but the emotional and the moral issues here really outweigh everything else for me. So.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I want to say thank you to Chair Katiza Watoon for bringing this forward. I think this is a difficult issue for many. You know, I also want to be clear that for a lot of families, you know, contrary to what some of the testifiers said, generally by the time a family gets to IVF, they've tried all the other things, right? This is their last best hope to have a family. It is not one that is undertaken lightly. It is not something that people go to first because it's expensive. It is an emotional roller coaster that is incredibly difficult to go through. I know several members of my family had struggled with infertility. One who had repeated miscarriages, and the personal toll that comes with that is incredibly heartbreaking. Eventually, they were able to have two children. My sister had been weighing different options for her. Adopting was not an option because she was diabetic. You know, that just wasn't something available to her. And I know we talk a lot about carrying this child and separating the child, but I mean, some of the same people that I heard testify today are the same folks who are champions for adoption. We want to carry that term. We want to treat children as that precious gift. And I do know that there are families out there looking for every available option, including IVF. It is a big deal. Now, why some pregnancies make it, why they don't, this is the challenge in trying to regulate healthcare for women, women's pregnancy, or their bodies, quite frankly. These are complex organisms, you know, people are complex. But every opportunity we have to give families an option, I think, makes an incredible difference in the ability to have that child. And I can tell you that for my family, ultimately being able to bring a life into this world made a world of difference. And I know that my family cherishes each and every baby, and we mourn each and every loss, as I do, I know a lot of families do. So I just wanted to say thank you for trying to find a path forward that does this. And I also understand the financial concerns. And certainly I appreciate the studies you offered that show no major difference in insurance coverage costs or premiums by covering this. And certainly while some folks do cover this coverage with their families, I think there are more people out there who truly need access to the coverage who simply can't get it. And so I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you. I'll need staff for some of this question, and then I would like the MCCL person if they're in the house, and then also the person from the Catholic Church up there. I'm just curious if staff can answer the question, Mr. Chair, is as a state, do we require to track the embryos and the sperm if we're keeping them? I'm just kind of curious, where do these counts come from if they're not from the state?
Representative Katizo Atun.
Just to clarify, Representative Hewitt, you're wondering where the 1.5 million embryo number is coming from. If that's not something that's tracked by the state of Minnesota.
So the state doesn't track this, so where this number is coming from, we don't know. And it doesn't sound like they track the other either. So are both the testifiers from the Catholic Church and the MCCL up there?
Ms. Hengi.
Oh, Family Council, MCCL, but the Catholic Church is good enough. It's not the Catholic Church, it's the Catholic Conference.
Representative Hewitt, if you want to restate your question.
Okay, thank you, and thanks, for Mr. Chair. Yeah, so the question is, a lot of your data you have given is really, I'm trying to find it, and even in the, you didn't submit any data testimony here. One of the submitted data was from the Heritage Foundation that simply says this is no more than just to put a more, and these people aren't opposed, to put another barrier in the way of families being able to do this for financial concerns. The church that I attend, I don't believe this would be one of their options to prevent a family. Can you tell me where your data comes from, or do you have your data available that you could share with the committee? Because as we're making this decision to put into a possible omnibus bill, I think we need to have the facts, and I got to tell you, I don't have much credibility in the Heritage Foundation, or there's another one in here from MCCL that uses a, I don't even know what this is called, but a clinic of some sort that isn't really a clinic. So I just need to, I don't mean to dig into this, but not only personally I'm interested in this data, but I think the committee should hear what, because some of those numbers were pretty big, and not hearing that these numbers come from the state, who should be, I guess, tracking these if that's what we're expected. If that's if you're throwing numbers out here, I just need the data. Do you have that available that you can share with the committee?
Representative Hewitt and Ms. Hange, I'll let you respond, but I think it might be best to submit that maybe by a brief or something to the committee if you need the time to collect it.
Sure. Thanks, Chair Bierman. Meg Hange, for the record. Rep. Hewitt, I'm happy to talk offline about this, too. Some of the things I cited came from the CDC, what I was able to... The 37% is from the CDC. I can share that with you. They track it nationally. They also do state-by-state tracking. It's a little harder to see at a global level on the state because they track clinic by clinic. So I use the national stats in what I talked about with that 37%. I don't know if you're asking about some of the other stats in here, but I'm happy to grab that for you and share it with whoever else needs it.
Thank you. We're going to take...
I'm just going to finish up, Mr. Chair, if I could real quick, just to say, yes, I would like that. And also, I would like current data. The CDC data that I'm seeing in this set of documents we got is from 2018. So anything that's more current than 2018 would be great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your diligence.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. We're going to take Representative Liebling and then Representative Van Binsbergen, and then we are going to lay this bill over. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to everybody for testifying. Thank you, Representative Katiza-Watun. So just a few comments here. First of all, I heard the Catholic Conference talk about coercion, and I thought that was in their, some of their written materials, too. And I frankly do not see how offering coverage for something coerces anybody into getting it. Also, just to touch on the discussion about surrogacy, which clearly is not intended to be in this bill, and maybe that could be tightened up, I don't know. But I just want to point out that we have, you know, for those who are concerned, I think rightly, that there aren't proper protections for women in the state of Minnesota for surrogates, we have tried to do that over the years. We have tried to put in a legal framework to protect surrogates and to make sure that there is no unfairness and so on. And we've been stymied in that because some of the same folks don't want it. So they're kind of arguing on both sides of their mouth, I think, on that surrogacy issue, you know, wishing it away. Well, you can't wish it away. It exists. People are using it. And in my view, we should have legal protections, but that's not in this bill. And saying it is, I think, is somewhat of a straw man. I've heard members talk about increasing health insurance premiums. Well, you can't have it both ways. Under this bill, and the way I think it works under the Affordable Care Act, the state has to reimburse the health insurance companies for this additional requirement, if it was to become one. Mm-hmm. That means that by definition, there should be no increase in premiums because of this. So the thing to look at is what will the state mm-hmm. be paying? And that's a fiscal note issue, not an issue of anybody's insurance increasing. I mean, it just isn't both. It can't be both, right? So I think that's a bit of a straw man argument, too. I did want to respond about the whole issue about, we don't know the cause of infertility. I'd like to know another medical condition that we refuse to cover because we don't know the cause. We may not know the cause of pancreatic cancer, but we sure do cover the treatment, right? So, again, I think, you know, we're kind of applying standards here that really don't apply in other areas. The same thing with, we shouldn't do this because we don't know what to do with the embryos. You know, I think that what that comes down to is wanting to make other people's ethical decisions for them. You know, if we think that this is something that is enough of an issue and a problem for Minnesotans that we should cover it and spend the money to cover it, I persist in believing it isn't kind of our business which ethical decision those families make at the end of the day. If we trust them to know when it's time to have a child, we ought to trust them to know what to do with embryos and how to conduct their own private business with that. So really what this comes down to for me, and I think it's, I think this has been touched on by Representative Nadeau and others, I think it really is a priorities issue because it's a fiscal issue. It's what can we afford And anytime we pay for something, we give up something else. So I think that that's really what it comes down to. I know that this year we're laying the bill over. We don't have a lot of money to spend. I'm pretty sure this isn't going to go forward this year for that reason. But I just think it's a matter of priorities. And, you know, we each, I suppose, weigh that differently. But I just wanted to speak up and say that I think a lot of these other concerns are really straw man arguments and need to be put aside. Thanks.
Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just have a quick question. There is a fiscal note on this, correct? And it's in the Senate file. And is the range is between, I heard 5 million, and then I heard 18 million, and then I heard 8.6 million. What's the number? And then I've also heard that the Department of Commerce is going to pay that bill. I'd just like a little explanation of, you know, does the Department of Commerce just make up their own cash flow and they've just got the cash standing there where do they get their money from?
Representative Katizo Toon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Van Binsbergen. As a fellow member of the Commerce Committee, you know where we get our money from, the general fund. But I did send the fiscal note to Mr. Dockendorf, and hopefully he's able to send it out to all the committee members. There is a cost to the general fund, and there's a cost to the Healthcare Access Fund. The total estimated cost for a future biennium is for fiscal year 2028, $4.3 million, and fiscal year 2029, $4.321 million. There is a cost for fiscal year 2027, which is $1.78 million. So the $8.6 million that I referenced would be the ongoing cost to the state for the public programs. And then if we were to move forward with large group only and not cover the public programs, given concerns about ongoing cost at this point, there would not be a cost based on the 25 other states that have shown that there is not an additional premium increase based on other mandates across the country. Hope that clarifies it.
Van Binsbergen, follow up?
Sure. Well, it's hard for me to believe if you're going to create a new mandate to this that and that it's not going to affect insurance companies and going to affect their rates. I spent the last week back home in my district, and every day I got calls from people concerned about, you know, they've been getting 20 and 30% rate increases in their premiums, and I'm very concerned about that for my constituents in my district. So, thank you.
We will go to the final comments, and that final comment, Representative Van Binsbergen, we should talk more about that offline here. Go ahead with your closing comments, please, Representative Katizo Watoon.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and Chair Backer, for hearing this bill today. Thank you, members, for a really great conversation. I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation, and I think, you know, I've been taking notes as we walked through, so I know that, you know, coverage limits is definitely something that we want to come back to between now and the end of session. We do have the opportunity to move forward with large group only if we choose not to cover the cost of public programs at this point in time. We can also discuss storage guidelines if that's something that would be meaningful to members on the other side of the aisle. I think when we talk about children and bringing children into the world, we know how expensive it is, right? We know how expensive it is to raise children, from labor and delivery costs all the way up to the cost of college if you're helping your child with that, or potentially buying, helping them purchase their first home or covering rent. It's really expensive. And I think that when we look at the declining population, not only here in Minnesota, but elsewhere globally, a big part of that is people are worried about being able to afford bringing a child into this world. I think that this is one of the ways where we can help people who wish to be parents, particularly in the state of Minnesota, because we are working to be the best place to raise children, to afford beginning and building their family. And there are so many amazing opportunities that we have because of
medicine in today's day and age that we haven't had access to before. So I think, you know, as technology continues to improve and we continue to examine some of the underlying causes, it's important to remember that this bill covers the diagnosis of infertility as well. So that is one of the reasons we can actually get to some of the underlying reasons why people are dealing with infertility and then move forward in on that line as well. So the research that's happening is important, but being able to support families as they explore building their family, I think, is the most important thing, and appreciate everyone's consideration. Myself and the advocates, and I know Senator McQuaid, are willing to have future conversations.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watoon. I renew the motion, House File 4609, to be laid over. The bill is now laid over. Thank you. We will move next to the governor's supplemental budget. We'll have first up the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services, please. First presenters, Ms. Underwood and Mr. Wright.
Yes. Yes, sir, no, sir. Check this box. I sent so many of those in elementary school, too. And I always got a no.
Oh, stop it. You did not, Danny.
I want you, John.
Aww.
We'll give you a no again.
That's a fond memory. You bring me back to that.
Well, we're going to give them a no.
I remember those days.
Sending you with love notes.
I'll let you get settled, and when you are ready, please just introduce yourself, and we will proceed.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I am Wendy Underwood, Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. Appreciate being with you here today. I will be very mindful of time.
Thank you very much.
Yep, absolutely. So we'll just go ahead and quickly just jump in. I mean, as you know, MDH's mission is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. We do this by ensuring thriving, vibrant communities through protecting people from the spread of infectious disease. It means clean water, access to health care, and other important community support, making it easier for all of us in Minnesota to be our healthiest, no matter who we are or where we live. We in public health focus on the upstream. We want to prevent illness and injury before it starts. Our proposal today is very brief, focused on some clarifications, technical fixes, and alignment. Do you have the presentation? Okay, great. Great. Okay, our first two items are follow-ups to recent legislation. The first one regarding the Minnesota All-Payer Claims Database. This proposal is connected to 2023 legislation requiring MDH to develop a process for researchers and organizations to access the Minnesota All-Payer Claims Database, or APCD, for approved research projects. That legislation also directed MDH to develop a fee schedule to be applied for external access to data for authorized researchers. This proposal establishes that fee schedule and gives MDH the necessary authority to collect those fees. So essentially, it's the second step of legislation that passed in 2023. As you may know, the APCD is a state repository of de-identified health insurance claims, enrollment information, and costs for services provided to Minnesota residents. This data offers a unique opportunity for Minnesota to learn more about the healthcare services and prescription drug products provided across the state, their utilization, costs, and health outcomes. Creating access to the APCD with the fee schedule outlined in this proposal is a public benefit to further advance evidence-based policies and to foster collaboration and innovation. Excuse me. The second item is a 2025 fix. During the last legislative session, fees related to HMO regulation were increased for the first time in more than two decades. However, the correlating and necessary appropriation did not accompany the fee increase, which was an oversight. So the department is asking for that fix. So the funds are already coming from the fee passed last year, but we're just missing that balanced out appropriation. So nothing new, just a cleanup. Our next few items are also very straightforward. The first one regards the healthcare loan forgiveness funds and an extension of use of those funds. We have two programs, the healthcare loan forgiveness program and the home and community-based services employee scholarship and loan forgiveness program, which both award loan forgiveness to participants agreeing to work in high-need settings and in home and community-based settings, providing services to seniors. This proposal would amend current statute governing the programs to allow appropriations to be spent, allow us to keep the appropriations until spent, rather than be canceled at the end of the biennium. This allows flexibility to award all loan forgiveness funds allocated to the programs on timelines that fit the program's multi-year design. The next item codifies an existing process. The newborn screening program is a mandated program that receives funding from fees. In the event that a birth parent or parents do not have insurance or the cost of the fee would be a hardship for the parents, this fee is waived, which is a long-standing allowance. But the fee exemption process is not in state statute, and so the department would like to codify that process. This next item involves rural clinical training. This proposal would modify the description of four grant programs designed to address workforce shortages of healthcare professionals in rural and underserved communities to better describe those program purposes. It's really clarifying language to minimize confusion for eligible health professionals. In the interest of time, I won't walk through all four of them. But I will share it's the Health Professionals Clinical Training Expansion Program, the Rural and Underserved Clinical Rotations Program, Primary Care Residency Training Grant Program, and the International Medical Graduate Assistance Program. The next item is something that, as longstanding members of this committee might be familiar with, has to do with substance use grants and hopefully one last technical fix related to these funds. In 2024, the substance use grant shifted from the newly established Office of Cannabis Management to MDH. And as a part of that shift, there was also some funds moved over to other prevention and prevention grants. In 2025, the governor recommended and the legislature passed another shift to better balance out the funding for general substance use treatment and recovery and prevention grants and cannabis use grants. When that shift happened last year, MDH inadvertently lost its ability to administer the grants. So a very technical oversight. So we had authority before, and we just need to clean that up and reinstate it. I will also note, Mr. Chair, not listed on this slide, and it is not in the language that came out earlier this week, but there is a very brief and budget-neutral item that involves removing outdated and unnecessary funding restrictions on tribal nations within the Local Public Health Act. In short, this language both recognizes tribal sovereignty and adds flexibility for tribes to determine their priorities for this funding, similar to the flexibilities already allowed to other local public health entities in Minnesota and in line with other areas of tribal public health funding. So there will be more information on that. Our last two items focus on simplification and streamlining of work between agencies. The first item regards a health plan regulatory alignment. As you may know, Minnesota is one of the only states in the country that divides health insurance oversight between two state agencies. This proposal transfers authority over HMOs and county-based purchasers, or CBPs, from the Department of Health to the Department of Commerce. While the two agencies closely collaborate in the enforcement work, this dual structure for private insurance oversight has led to the need for interagency agreements to govern work that each agency does on the other's behalf, which can lead to inefficiencies and confusion for consumers. So this proposal should help Minnesota consumers and make it easier for Minnesotans to access the support they need navigating the private insurance market. Lastly, regarding the last item regards the transfer of coordination for crisis phone services from DHS. So as a part of adult mental health efforts, the Department of Human Services currently receives funding to support regionally coordinated comprehensive suicide prevention services. DHS administers these funds via an interagency agreement to MDH, and then we conduct the work after that. So this proposal simply directs the funding to MDH instead of DHS to simplify and streamline the overall process. Mr. Chair, I did have a last slide just regarding an update on federal funding and federal termination of funds. In the interest of time, I can pass on that or and just say briefly it's under injunction.
Under injunction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I read that in the paper the other day. So I think this is good for now. We're going to move to DHS and then get the rest of the bill heard today.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate your time and bringing this forward. Members, as you have questions on this, take notes. We'll be bringing it back so you can have your questions. But we wanted to get through the bill today.
Really appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
So our last item then on the agenda would be to have Elise Bailey, Budget Director, Minnesota Department of Human Services. And please note, members, we are focusing today on the parts of the DHS budget that are within our committee's jurisdiction. So when you are ready, please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed.
Well, thank you, Chair Bierman and members of the committee. I'm Elise Bailey. I'm the budget director for the Department of Human Services, and I'm joined by my colleague, Mary Gilbertson, who is our legislative budget director in the Healthcare Administration. And so before I dive in, I thought I would just give a few slides on kind of where we are entering our budget season this year, what our budget looks like, and what we're proposing in your jurisdiction. So in fiscal year 2026, our current budget is around $28 billion, and of that, about 54% of that is from federal funds. $10.6 billion is from the general fund. In terms of how we spend our budget, about 89% of that is in the medical assistance program, and 6% is in our other forecasted programs, such as Minnesota Care, the Behavioral Health Fund, and a few other smaller forecast programs. 3% of our budget is spent on grants now that DCYF is their own agency and direct care and treatment is their own agency. And about 2% of our budget is on operations. So all of the systems funding and all of the FTEs within the agency is around 2% of our budget. I would say that's pretty important in terms of moving into what our proposals are this year in that we need the administrative resources to carry out, particularly the medical assistance program. The way our budget works is those funds, you know, can't be transferred across the two different buckets of funding. And so when there's increases in medical assistance spending, if there's increases in the forecast, we don't have commensurate increases in the administrative and systems funding needed to administer the program. Just a snapshot of our Medicaid program in fiscal year 26. So we're projected to spend about $24 billion, and about 57% of that is funded through federal funds. That varies across the eligibility categories and services across the medical assistance program. And why this is important as we get into the HR1 provisions of our governor's budget, a lot of the items impact that adults without kids category, where we get a 90% match from the federal government versus in many of the other areas we get around 50%. We serve about 1.2
million average monthly enrollees in the medical assistance program. So all of the changes that HR1 is making and all of the changes in our budget are impact quite a lot of people across the state. So diving into our budget, and this is across all of the jurisdictions, but we have five pillars that our budget is founded on this year. One is to take a step back and kind of think about transforming the human services system. You know, if we were to build it today, would it look like how we have it with all its complexities and different players? How can we streamline and make the system work better for people? The second pillar is, of course, responding to federal action, with a big piece of that being HR1, and I'll go over that. We have about 10 proposals in the program integrity bucket, and within that, many, many, many different components within those proposals. Those don't fall in this jurisdiction, but I would note there are substantial proposals in that lane. Fourth, we have a few proposals on targeted investments in behavioral health. Again, those fall in the other jurisdiction. And we have a few proposals on curbing spending growth, particularly in the out biennium, where we still have a structural deficit at the state level. That also, luckily, is in the other jurisdictions, so you won't have to deal with those today. This slide just goes over across jurisdiction what our final numbers are in our proposals. We have 35 distinct proposals, with savings of $240 million in this biennium and $489 million in the tails. So going into the content of our budget. So why transform the human services system? We know that today our system is really challenging for people to navigate. We have multiple players in the system, and we have laws and rules that make it really, really challenging for people to get access to the healthcare and services that they need. That complexity has grown over time. You know, when Medicaid was first established, it looked very different than it did today, and even 10 years ago, it looked really different. Every year, we add more and more complexity to the program, and many times for good reason. We're adding new benefits for people or new ways of doing things where that are evidence-based. But it does mean that the complexity has grown, and without taking a step back to think about how we need to functionally administer the program, it's become a challenge for those of us that are administering them. We've also seen disinvestment and underinvestment in the administrative resources over time. As I mentioned, you know, our administrative budget is 2 to 3% of our total budget, and most nonprofits or other entities couldn't operate on a margin that small, and that is an index to growth in the program. And so over years and years, that has led to disinvestment in the core functions of what it really takes to administer the program well. That also exists on the local level. We have counties who play really key pivotal roles along with tribes, and they're also challenged with coming up with the administrative resources to do that work well. We also have a hybrid fee-for-service and managed care system where there's siloed approaches to how we set rates, what networks people can access, and the program integrity approaches to mitigate liability to the state, both from a accessing service standpoint for people and the financial risk. That makes it challenging to operate in a holistic perspective if we have multiple different ways that we're operating the program. Lastly, decentralization of roles, while in some instances is a good thing, you know, having local people serve people where they live, that is important in some aspects, but it also results in different policies, procedures, rules, depending on where you live, whether you're receiving managed care or fee-for-service, and who operates your benefit. So these are the kind of drivers that are driving us to take a step back and kind of think about how we would build it if we were to build it today. So within this proposal, it's found in our budget book, which is actually published this year since it's a policy year, on DHS's website, linked in the presentation on page 3, In total, this proposal is about $17 million in the first biennium and $55 million in the tails. And it has five different components within it, which I'll go over each one. The first one is elimination of the use of managed care organizations. So 45% of our spending on medical assistance is through managed care. Of the basic care portion of the program, it's 80%. And through that, I'm sure this committee knows, but we pay managed care organizations a monthly capitation payment, so an average per member per month amount, and then they pay the claims on our behalf. With that, the MCOs are setting their own rates, they're setting their own networks that essentially establishes where people can access services. They're setting their own prior authorization and billing requirements and their own program integrity processes. With that, we've seen over the years that the risk to the state in terms of financial risk has really fallen not on the managed care organizations, but on the state. For example, this year in the November forecast, we had to increase managed care rates by an average of 16% because we are required to keep those rates actuarially sound. And in order to do that, our actuaries look at the costs from the previous year, and the costs went up. But we don't have authority to set the rates or all of these billing processes that they have or the networks. And so that financial, originally the managed care setup was to actually mitigate financial risk to the state, that they would be managing within the capitation payment. But that has been minimized over time, and the financial risk has fallen to the state. Same with program integrity risks. In terms of managed care organizations are contractually required to have their own methods for program integrity. However, if we have eight different ways of folks doing that, plus the fee-for-service way of doing program integrity, it means that that is a siloed approach where we don't have a full, holistic perspective of the whole program. So with this proposal, we are proposing to transition to an administrative service organization model beginning January 1st, 2029. This model would essentially create a new entity, or we would contract with a new entity that would be responsible for the administrative functions that the managed care organizations are currently responsible for. But the state would instead retain all of the policy decisions, so the rates, the network, the prior authorization, the billing requirements. We would set the program integrity requirements. And the outcomes we're seeking to achieve would be that no matter where I live in the state, I would have access as somebody receiving health care through medical assistance, I would have access to the same network, the same rules, the same processes, the same access points. No matter where I live or who I'm working with. Another big outcome we're looking to achieve is that the state and the legislature, you all, would set the actual policy decisions for the Medicaid program rather than another entity. That can help influence, it can better enable us to influence spending in the program and mitigate financial risk moving forward and incorporate better program integrity processes across the whole program. A second part of this proposal is shifting some MA eligibility functions. So as I mentioned, we are one of 10 states with a state-supervised county-administered human services program. And as part of that, counties and tribal nations are responsible for determining a person's eligibility for Medicaid. Some of the challenges that we've seen over the years as the increased complexity, as I mentioned, are aging systems where our county partners have to do a lot of manual workarounds. We have multiple different eligibility rules depending on what program the person is seeking. They have large caseloads, and as you'll see in later slides with HR1 as a good example, unfunded federal mandates where counties are really forced to manage the workload within fewer resources and higher complexities. With this proposal, we're not seeking to pull all of that back from counties, but rather just look, taking the functions that are more manual in nature or special programs that have special eligibility criteria and taking that on at the state level from the counties beginning January 1st, 2028. A second phase of this would then study the rest of the functions for eligibility and co-create a strategy with our counties and tribal partners on any functions that would want to shift at a future date. Some outcomes we're seeking to achieve are really to ease the administrative burden at the county and tribal level. And one thing I would mention with tribal nations with this proposal, they can opt out or in, given their sovereign nature of the tribal nations who are, some of them are conducting eligibility. But that we are seeking to ease those administrative burdens by taking on the more manual work. We're also looking to have a more seamless enrollee experience. As one part of the cost of this proposal is to have one central place where we would keep documents that we could communicate with our county and tribal partners with. And then lastly, co-create a long-term strategy, utilizing this proposal to take a step back and co-create what our strategy should be moving forward. I will kind of breeze through this. Another item, this is in the other jurisdiction, but another pain point with counties are related to the MnChoices assessment. So whereas the other slide was centered around financial eligibility, this piece is centered around functional eligibility, so the eligibility for people who are trying to access long-term care. With this proposal, we are seeking to supplement what the counties are doing, so add a team at DHS to assist counties in areas where they have large backlogs. This slide is centered around the waiver case management piece, which also is in the other jurisdiction, so I'll just breeze through since we have limited time. And the last piece of this proposal is to do a comprehensive study on all of the programs that DHS is administering in terms of the role of the state, counties, and tribal nations in the administration of the programs. We would want to come back to the 2029 legislature with recommendations. What would be in scope would be all of DHS's programs, including Medicaid, Minnesota Care, the Behavioral Health Services, housing programs, economic assistance, interlicensing and oversight functions. We also would include some DCYF programs, such as their licensing functions. They have a fraud prevention investigation program that they're working with counties on and tribal nations on, their economic assistance, child support, and CCAP programs. We would be looking at what is the status quo, so what are the roles right now of counties, tribes, and the state in all of these programs, and assess how other states administer it, focusing on the roles of local governments versus state agencies. We'd want to look at not only those nine other states that have a county-administered system, but also the other states that have most of the roles at the state level. And we would want to assess the financing of the Human Services Administration across the state agency, counties, and tribal nations. As I mentioned, you know, on both sides, it's really been a challenge to keep up with the demand and complexity of the program. So we would want to look at how are we funded right now on the local level. We don't even know where all of the resources are coming from or how much it really costs our county partners to administer the program. So we would want to know the status quo, but also how much should it cost? What is the level of administrative resources that we would need to actually effectively run these programs well? We would then want to come back to the legislature with recommendations on what the ideal delegation of duties should be, and include financing strategies that consider things like workforce. If we wanted to hire more folks, but it would be hard to hire them, not enough labor, we would want to consider that in the report. We would also want to consider our systems. What are ways that we could adapt our systems to make more efficient use of time and resources, as well as timing considerations? Okay, moving on to the next bucket of proposals, responding to federal action. So, of course, HR 1 passed on July 4th of this year, and it made sweeping changes to Medicaid that will impact all corners of the state. We have a map on this slide that shows the proportion of people receiving MA by region. And as you can see, that proportion is quite large across the state, particularly in greater Minnesota.
This will impact not only people receiving medical assistance, but the healthcare infrastructure within those regions of the state, all across the state. We know that these changes will result in the loss of coverage for some Minnesotans. We also know that we will see an increase in uncompensated care for providers and hospitals. It will increase complexity, speaking to the slides of, earlier, in accessing and administering medical assistance. And there are some portions of HR1 that will reduce federal funding to states. So what our budget does is it seeks to mitigate these impacts to Minnesotans and minimize the burdens, particularly on our county and tribal partners as they have to roll out these changes. So we have two proposals related to HR1. This first one is centered around the changes related to eligibility, and the second one is related to changes related to financing. This can be found on page 13, and in total, $124,000 in this biennium and a savings of around $37 million in the tails. So the first item in this proposal is six-month eligibility renewals for certain Medicaid enrollees. So effective January 1st, 2027, HR 1 requires states to conduct eligibility redeterminations every 6 months for our adult expansion enrollees who are not American Indian or Alaskan Natives. Currently, we do renewals annually, and so this proposal will conform state law with this requirement. As part of that, we, of course, need administrative resources to implement this item, as well as resources for navigators as their key partners in assisting people seeking renewal and re-enrollment. The second piece in this proposal is obtaining enrollee address information. HR1 requires states to use data from managed care plans, the post office, the National Change of Address Database, return mail, and other sources to regularly update enrollee addresses. What our proposal does is it conforms to state law and provides the administrative funding to implement. We will need to have resources to hit those databases as well as administrative costs to ensure that we are complying with this requirement. The next one is work requirements. So effective January 1st, 2027, MA applicants and enrollees who are ages 21 through 64, who do not have kids, who are not pregnant and not seeking MA based on a disability, also known as our expansion population, will be subject to work or community engagement requirements if they do not meet an exemption. The federal guidelines lay out several ways folks can meet an exemption. What our proposal does is it conforms state law to these requirements and provides funding to implement the provision. One key portion of the funding is for us to utilize an external vendor to assist counties and the state in processing this change. So making sure that we can isolate the folks that are impacted by this requirement, that if there's no data in our system that shows that they either meet an exemption or they meet the work requirements, that we are effectively communicating with those enrollees and gathering the information needed to ensure that they're eligible for the program. One key thing that we've seen in other states, such as Georgia, that rolled out work requirements is that a lot of folks who weren't eligible for the program, it wasn't because they didn't meet the requirements. It was the administrative burden in applying and doing the documentation. So we're really trying to focus on being as effective as possible in reaching enrollees, and hiring an external entity will be important in that regard. The total impact in terms of dollars of these last three items, work requirements, six-month renewals, and obtaining address information is $11 million in this biennium and $33.7 million in the tails. Our proposal also conforms state law to the retroactive coverage period in the HR1 bill. Currently, our state law allows up to 3 months of retroactive coverage prior to the month of application. And HR1 limits federal retroactive coverage to 1 month before the date of application for the adult expansion populations and 2 months for all other eligibility groups. Currently, our forecast assumes that because our state law says 3 months, that those incremental months no longer allowed under the federal government are covered through all state funds. This proposal modifies state law to align with the federal, the retroactive period that would be covered by a federal match. Therefore, is about $11 million in savings on this biennium and $70 million in the tails. So moving on to the second HR1 proposal centered around financing related response. This proposal implements cost sharing requirements for adults who are with incomes between 100 and 133% of federal poverty level. This one's effective October 1st, 2028. And it would implement the cost sharing that we had prior to the 2023 session, so that same fee schedule that we had back then, with the limitations that the HR1 bill had, such as it cannot exceed 5% of the person's income, it cannot exceed $35, and there are a long list of services that cost sharing wouldn't be applicable to. So we would, with this provision, we would be seeking in our proposal the administrative resources to do the changes needed to ensure that we're complying with that provision. The second item would strengthen our oversight and support for county and tribal nations to increase our eligibility determination accuracy and audit preparedness. So another item in HR1 was it limited CMS's ability to waive penalties if a state's error rate was exceeds 3%. Right now CMS is able to waive that if a state is showing that they're resolving the issues. And in this case, if we have all these changes to eligibility, there's a risk that a future audit could find a greater than 3% error rate. So with our proposal, we're just seeking administrative funds to work with the counties and tribal nations and to ensure that we're looking over eligibility determinations on a more frequent basis so that when there is an audit, we have already corrected any issues that may have been found earlier. And I will just breeze through. The other two were neutral items. For your reference, because I'm running out of time, this is a timeline of all the HR1 provisions by the effective date. And with that, maybe, Chair, I may stop, if that's okay. These are budget neutral provisions, unless folks want me to keep going.
I think you have a couple more minutes. If you want to just get through the slides, that would be helpful.
That sounds good, Chair. Okay, the first one is Rural Emergency Hospital Payment Methodology Technical Change. This is, again, budget neutral on page 129. It establishes a rate methodology for critical access hospitals that convert to rural emergency hospitals. Just enables us to convert that rate methodology. The second item provides technical changes to our statewide hospital-directed payment program that was established in the 25 legislative session. These are neutral changes that conform the statute with how we're rolling out that directed payment program. The third one modifies the definition of residency for non-Title IV-E foster kids. So it allows kids that are moving to Minnesota that are placed in a Minnesota foster care home by another state but aren't eligible for Title IV-E that they would be considered Minnesota residents for purposes of MA eligibility. The fourth item sunsets the supplemental payment for Hennepin County Medical Mental Health Clinic. This is just a conforming change that places an end date on a current authority that we have to make a supplemental payment because it's no longer used or needed because they have transitioned to a CCBHC model or Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic. And then lastly, we have a proposal that spans jurisdictions. It's our budget technical changes proposal that just modifies, provides technical changes within appropriations that we got that may have been in the wrong budget activity or technical language corrections. It also provides carry forward in instances where we're seeking that and specifies direct payments for tribal and county governments. And with that, I'll pause.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey and Ms. Gilbertson, for being here today. We will invite you back. I'm sure members have questions. I have a bunch, so we will plan to have you back at our last meeting for a period of time just to take some questions from members. And with that, members, our business is concluded today. We are adjourned.